Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
My guest today is creative director at the Tokyo-based studio Tango Gameworks. Born in Long Island, New York, he played in a Radiohead covers band while in high school. After graduating with a degree in East Asia Studies from Brandeis University, he moved to Japan to work as an English teacher. There he started translating Japanese books into English in his spare time. A keen player of video games, in 2010 my guest applied to work at Tango Gameworks, the studio founded by the legendary horror director Shinji Mikami. He joined and there worked first as a translator, then as a designer on The Evil Within, before assuming the role of director on that game's two DLC episodes and the full sequel. In 2023, he directed the studio's innovative music combat game Hi-Fi Rush, which has just launched for PlayStation 5. Welcome, John Johannes.
I'm happy to be here. Nice to meet you, Simon.
Nice to meet you too, John. So it's 7 in the evening in... are you in Tokyo or...?
I am in Tokyo, yes, yeah.
Okay. I'm assuming you've clocked off for the day.
Oh, no, it just begins. It only begins.
Japanese working hours.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, what have you been doing today?
I'm just doing... It's a lot of documentation work. You know, when people think of a creative director or something like that, you think kind of just maybe in an office and calling in people and telling them what to do. But I like to be very hands-on with the work I do. So, you know, I sit with a team. If a document needs to be made about something and I have an idea about it, instead of delegating it, sometimes if it's something I obviously am not very good at or can't explain well, I'll ask somebody to do that. But if it's like, oh, I know exactly what I want to do, you know, I love opening just PowerPoint and whipping up something quick and being like, oh, it's like this, you know.
Yeah.
So it feels like, you know, you're still part of it. I don't like to be removed from the game making experience, which can happen, I think, the higher you go up in the chain.
Right. Yeah, interesting. And let's talk about Hi-Fi Rush. So it's such an interesting project. It's, you know, extremely stylish and fresh, but it also feels a bit like a game that doesn't get made very often these days. Yeah. It's got like a sort of a Dreamcast or PlayStation 2 era feel. And I mean that in that absolute like most positive way possible. You know, in the sense that it's got this unique art style. It's got a unique mechanic. It's a new IP. It's not trying to be Fortnite or League of Legends, which seem to be the kind of games that, you know, a lot of investors want to fund these days. So I'm wondering, like, how did you get it made?
Yeah.
Like, who were the people you had to convince to let you do this?
It was a process to do it. Luckily, you know, just pitching the idea internally, the first reaction was initially very positive. I was very upfront with it. I was like, this is not some sort of big open world game. This is almost should feel like like what you described it as. It should feel like a throwback, but not something that feels like a retro game, something that feels like a game that could exist today. It has the quality of life features. It feels modern, but also feels like a game that you remember being just fun to play. And a lot of the references you said, like Dreamcast Games PlayStation 2 era and stuff like that. And those are the same words I used to describe it. And I pitched it internally, you know, and the pitch was pretty much what the game is. Maybe there's one or two things that slightly changed, but otherwise it's the version that your people who are playing the game are playing today. And
can I just cut in? When you say you pitched it, like, what are you showing? Like, are you just literally describing it in front of a room of people?
So I made a quick documentation. I'm trying to remember how many pages, maybe about like 7 or 8 pages of like a pitch document. It's like, hey, this is the idea for the game, you know, and this is kind of the world that I think it'll be in. This is how I think it'll play. And this is what I want it to feel like when we're done with it. And, you know, when I say what it should be like, it's just how the game was. It's like a 3D action game that feels like you're kind of curating music video and you're fighting to the music. You know, it's very dynamic in that sense. The world was the same thing. It says like you're a person who acts like it's a music player put in their chest and they're kind of labeled a defect and they have to fight against this corporation and they fight actual bosses. That was part of the initial pitch. And then I kind of just showed, you know, the 3D action idea of it's like, it's not a side scroller. It's, you know, you're looking from above, you're fighting in all directions. And then I kind of focused on, I had this page where I went, remember these type of games? And it was like what you said, like it was, you know, pictures of things like Jet Set Radio or like Okami or like Beautiful Joe and stuff like that. And these colorful, fun looking games that you kind of remember of like, man, those games were great. Why don't we make those games anymore? And it's like something that appeals to that audience. You know, it's very sort of blue skies take. It's positivity, just having fun. Obviously, I'm pushing this in front of my boss at the time, Shinji Mikami, who has worked on those games. So it's actually, to him, it's not that big of a surprise. But also in the room, there are some people from Bethesda. And you know, like a studio that's only known for making, at this point, The Evil Within. Internally, we had Greenlit, and we're moving on, making on Ghostwire Tokyo. And Bethesda is obviously not known for their sort of blue skies approach, you know, for their lineup of games. Not to say that's bad, but that's just, you know, not their sort of in their repertoire. And I threw that out and I was like, this is not gonna probably get past this table, but I really want to pitch this idea because I think, you know, for our studio as well, I think it's good for us to try something different and new. And I want something that's almost as far away as you can get. And we can, let's see how that works.
Right.
Yeah, so that's kind of how it went. And like I said, the response initially was actually very positive in that sense.
Very so cool. I'm interested because, you know, when you're pitching to Shinji Mikami, who worked on, like you say, on some of these games that you're referencing, you know, that's, he's, like you say, exactly knows that stuff. And I guess some of, like, the more senior people at Bethesda are also kind of older and probably grew up with some of these games you're referencing. But then at the other end of the scale, like, I guess you've got like junior designers and things like that who maybe see those games as like boomer stuff almost. It's like, I wasn't even like around when Jet Set Radio came out or whatever. Are you like getting them to go back and play some of these games to get the vibe that you're going for?
It's interesting that, you know, I didn't, or at least no one said it out loud, that they didn't know those games that I was referencing. I guess they're so, at least ingrained in sort of gamer culture at this point, that, again, I think even if you haven't played it, the impression that you get from just seeing an image of it was enough that you can be like, okay, I know what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Again, we weren't making like Jet Set Radio. We were doing something different, but you can just look at a picture of that and be like, I understood. And also, you know, for our art team as well, you know, they're very familiar with you know, any game that sort of that experiments with their art style. So they're very keen to knowing like how a game did what the touch was and how could we do something that's new. And we look at that stuff as more of as an inspiration jumping point rather than a sort of matching point. So
the in the just for anyone who hasn't played it, in the game the world is sort of pulsing to this beat of the music that's playing and you play as a character moving through the world and you have to time your button presses in time with the music, kind of to defeat enemies in combat.
Yep, that's me. And you're probably wondering how I ended up here. Well, it's pretty standard. Check this out. Music player in my chest. It's powering up my new robot arm.
Whoa.
It's making everything sync up with the beat. Let's rock. This is awesome. Vandalay Technologies isn't just coming for my arm. They're after all of us.
That's the defect!
It seems to me like to test that idea out, you've got to do just tons of work, right? To create a world that's like pulsing with music and then to do all of those mechanics. How did you just go about like testing the very essence of the concept to see if you had something that could be fun?
Yeah, so that was actually the key point in making that game was we knew that if we didn't nail that aspect of like playing to the music of the world sort of become and the action just feeling like part of the music, then it wasn't going to work out in the end of the production cycle. So we started with just making a prototype, and it was literally two people. It was myself and our lead programmer on the project, and I had the idea of what the final game play would be like, and I had to sort of talk through about how we would time inputs and how that would match up and how we would synchronize it to music. And it was about 9 months of like trial and error to get just this basic combat system of like, and it's, I think the videos are kind of out there. If you look for them, you can see our prototype, some kind of shots of it, but the core elements are all in there. You have your light attacks, your heavy attacks, like 1 beat attacks, 2 beat attacks, and they connect with combos to put this musicality to it. And it's one of those things that like when you nail it and when it feels good, it's so obvious. But when you're making it, it is so incredibly difficult to figure out like how do you tune this to make it feel like you're still in control, but you're not constrained by the music, but you feel like in control. And that was something that, it did take. If we set a time limit of 9 months, it's like if we can't get this in 9 months, then I don't think we're ever going to get it.
Yeah. And at what point in that 9 months were you like, yeah, this is going to work?
In my head, like from the beginning, I want to say, oh, I knew it would work right away. But we did some like early versions of it and we tried it with like temporary assets and we realized that wasn't working. It was eventually when we realized what kind of animations we needed to make it synchronize better. And then we put that in. I want to say like the last 3 months, like 3 months before we finished the prototype. And then when we got those basic attacks running in there, I was like, okay, this is cool. And when we add this on, it's going to be cooler. So when we add this on, it's going to be cooler. And that's very, very hard in general when you're making games to get people to see that, oh, this is cool, this is going to be fun. Because a lot of people, even game developers, it's very hard for some people to see that fun until all the elements are in there. But we were dealing with like, there was no visuals to this as well. Also imagine that it's like just a completely gray environment and we were doing it. But we still managed to have fun in that. We said, if it's fun like this, imagine if we do it with this kind of world that we're imagining where it's colorful and everything's moving to the music and it's animated.
Yeah, you're kind of looking for like, if we can make something that's enjoyable when it's like the ugliest, most boring thing to look at, then you're onto a winner, right?
Yeah, because we had that problem when we were making, it's not a problem per se, but like when we were making the Evil Within or horror games and, they're visually based. So if you're trying to make a prototype of a horror game without any visuals, there's nothing really interesting about it. So it's just you walking through a corridor and it's like, see aim your gun and shoot an enemy.
Yeah.
And it's really at the end when it comes together. So it's like, well, yeah, if you can make something where the gameplay itself is compelling with no visual aspect, then it's just going to get better and better and better.
Yeah. So cool. Thanks for talking about all that. Right. So, yeah, we'll come to the premise of the podcast, John. So I've asked you to pick the 5 video games you'd like to put on your very own perfect fictional games machine. I'm so excited to talk about these 5 games. You picked 5 absolute classics. So, yeah, we're going back to 1994 for this first one. What's your first choice and why do you love it?
Okay. So I remember this. I saved the name of the game and then you're immediately going to jump into the music of the game, right?
Yeah.
So I can't even just follow up and say anything. So I'll be like, don't you dare jump into the music with this. My first game is Earthbound. or mother too, if you are from Japan, of course, right? So I played this when it came out, actually. It's very odd because, you know, that game notoriously was like had a very bizarre marketing cycle. Did it even release in Europe? Was it one of the ones that didn't get released in Europe?
No, US only, I think.
Okay, yeah. And it came with that giant box with the strategy guide in it, because honestly, if you didn't have the strategy guide, the game was basically unplayable because it was so obtuse to play.
Which is now like worth $1,000 or something, right? On eBay or whatever.
Anybody want to buy mine? Because I can use $1,000 right now. But yeah, so I remember buying that. Well, I remember renting it from Blockbuster. You know, Blockbuster Video, if you're in the United States, you know, it's just where you'd rent video games. You'd normally rent a video game for 3 days. You go on a Friday and you come back on Sunday. And the next time you want to rent it again, somebody saves over your data. So you don't have to start at the beginning. So, like, I eternally only saw the beginning of the game, and I never really... And I thought the game was basically unplayable. Like, it was so difficult, and I didn't really know what to do, and I was very young. You know, I was born in 1986. So it came out in 1994, you said?
94, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 8 years old, maybe 9 years old or something when I was playing it. It's like, I had no concept about, like, equipping items and getting stronger and stuff like this. I thought, like, maybe just leveling up was enough, but...
Yeah, and, like, Japanese RPGs weren't very big at the time, right? So, like you say, it's not like there's a big sort of culture and history of these for Westerners at that time. You know, Earthbound was one of the first ones to make it really big, right?
Yeah, but still, I don't think it was really big, per se, because it was such a, like, a minor... game. Obviously, I think around that time you have like Chrono Trigger and stuff like that. There are these other like major RPGs or Final Fantasy VI that were coming out, and those were like the clearly high profile ones. And this was this like weird, obscure thing. And it was, like I said, it was so bizarre that you needed that strategy guide to basically even make any sense of what to do. I mean, looking back at it, of course, you can kind of get through it. But at the time, everything was kind of like, it was like you were kind of going through somebody's dream that like you weren't a part of. But because it was so bizarre, it like everything in that game just kind of was really kind of like set in my memory, and I still remember it a lot. You know, like the sequences you're involved with, looking back, made no sense whatsoever. Like erasing a pencil with a pencil eraser, then erasing an eraser with an eraser to move ahead, and the Mr. Saturn characters, and even the final boss that you have to, I mean, looking back, it is like really just terribly interesting to pull off, is like you have to pray to defeat it. You can't even defeat it's like you can't even comprehend the attacks that it's sending, and you have to but you know, from an 8-year-old player, it's like this game was this like fever dream of bizarre ideas, but there was something about it that was also like quite charming. I think, you know, the kind of the world, the setting, it was light but also these extremely dark elements to it. And it just felt different.
I guess for a young American boy like yourself, even though it's a Japanese-made game, it's kind of set in suburban America, right? And you play as like an 8-year-old kid, don't you, in a stripy T-shirt running around the streets. And
yeah.
You can use the phone boxes. And so like it's, like you say, sort of strange and mystical, but also familiar in quite mundane ways.
Yeah, but it was kind of that, you know, I think it's the classic sort of like, I think it was... Japanese team, what they imagine American culture to be.
Right, right.
So it's like, yeah, people running around the street, like with knives, like beating each other with bats, like eating full pizzas. And it's like, maybe now it's actually more closer to reality. I don't know about in 1994.
Prophetic.
Yeah, but yeah, they knew what was coming. But yeah, it's just such a bizarre thing. And then you obviously learn more about the game, and you learn about Shige Sato-san, like the type of person he is. And he was basically, you know, he's kind of like, what do they, like, they call him like a Renaissance man, you know, like person who's like kind of good in like everything, and like, yep, advertising and writing and all this stuff. And it was so bizarre. He basically almost got like a blank check from Nintendo. It's like, hey, I want to make this bizarre RPG that basically only people who like me will like. And they must said, okay. And it sold well here, right? But in the States, everyone was like, what is this thing? But I just think it's such a cool, like, almost like a relic of its time. It's like still stands out. It's like so bizarre. And I do remember, this is like really funny because I remember I was playing it on like the Game Boy Advance when I was once on a business trip with my boss at the time, Mikami-san. He was like, oh, what are you playing? And I was like, oh, I was just playing Mother 2 again on my thing. And he was like, oh, do you really like that game? And I was like, yeah, I grew up and I really liked it and I think it's fun. He's like, you know, that's one of those games where people say if that's their favorite game, it's like, I'm normally like, I take a step back.
Oh, really?
Or if they're a game designer, I kind of don't trust them. And I understand why. It's because that game is completely made from the perspective of you have this one person at the top who's like, I think this is interesting. I'm going to put this in. I don't care if anybody else likes it. I don't care if this sells. It's like, I just think this is fun to put in, even if it makes no sense. So from like a actual like making a product standpoint, it's such a weird thing that it was actually able to be released, like Nintendo was okay with putting it out or something like that. I mean, it's beloved in that sense, so it's a success in that aspect. But
yeah, it worked out. Like you say, it's got such a cult following. And then Mother 3, which never came out in the West at all, had a fan translation that people absolutely love. And the character like turns up in Smash Brothers and stuff. So even though, like you say, for quite an obscure game, it's had a big cultural impact within, you know, video game culture, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like, because it obviously it totally bombed in the States. That was like historically, like it formed terribly. And it's only, I'm trying to remember like what year that people finally kind of look back at it and remember like, wow, that was actually good. But I do remember, yeah, Ness being included in Smash Brothers, the first Smash Brothers. A lot of people just like, who the hell is this guy? And I was just like, oh my God, you know, there he is. And I was just super excited about that. But yeah, like it's kind of proves that, you know, these quirky, weird ideas, they stay with you, I think, longer than more safer ideas as well. You know, granted, obviously, it was a big risk at the time, but it paid off for making sort of like a cultural classic, I think.
Yeah, very true. Cool. So yeah, I mean, you were playing this game. I said in the intro, you grew up in Long Island in New York. Is that true? Is that where you were?
That is true. I did not lie. Yeah. I was living there. Yes.
Well, I meant because I said you were born there. Were you still there when you were like a kid, I guess? Yeah.
I was born and raised. Yeah. Yeah. So
cool. Cool.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was exactly like Earthbound. Yeah. It was just, beating up ATM machines with a bat. No, it was, you know, when you live in like suburban, you know, Long Island is not. Because they would say you're from New York. And then people would say, oh, New York, like New York City. And then it's like people think of New York City as Manhattan. Actually, New York City can extend into like the five boroughs as well. But I'm just outside of the five boroughs as well. So it's very suburban, close, but not close enough to be that I can. Then if I said grew up in New York City, perhaps someone from New York City would look at me and probably be offended and say, you are not a true New Yorker.
I see, right.
However, Long Island is not without its merits, I guess. It is home to many malls and not much to do. So therefore, there's enough time to play video games. And
right,
like
right.
That. But it is close enough that if you want to see live concerts or something, you can take the train in. And you can go into Manhattan and you can see lots of cool shows. And so access was available, but it was kind of like a slow life. But if you wanted to, you can jump on the train and kind of see that that bustling city.
Obviously, like music's important to you. Were you like mainly into bands and stuff? Or were you mainly into games when you were a teenager?
That's a good question. I mean, I grew up playing music in general. So I grew up, I mean, I took piano lessons as a kid, which I hated, and I played in just the symphonic band in school, like the alto saxophone, but I also played in the jazz band with the alto saxophone. And then when I was in high school, I picked up bass guitar and then went to regular guitar and went back to piano, just like less classical piano, more like keyboards, like chords and things like that. And in college, I even did some drumming. So I was definitely into music, but probably in middle school or so is when you started to like actually listen to artists. And then in high school is when you kind of like found the artists you really like.
Yes.
And luckily I found a, you know, we mentioned in the intro that I played in a Radiohead cover band, but I think that was really influential for me because they're also a great artist. They have a very interesting arc to their career. They do things that they, you can tell that I don't think they're worried about the commercial success of their things. They do it for this artistic merit to it. But, and this is not meant with any sort of like disrespect, but when you learn to play their songs, they seem extremely complicated, but they're actually very, very simple. They're very, very talented in how they're able to compose interesting compositions from simple chord progressions and things like that. And over time, granted, they've gotten much more professional because they're professional musicians. They've gotten much more better playing music that actually I can't even like play them casually anymore, the songs anymore, because they're getting too difficult to play. But that helped me a lot of like just learning about how far can you take something simple and experiment with it and make it interesting and things
very
like that.
Very interesting. Were you the Johnny Greenwood character then in your cover band?
I was doing singing and playing guitar. So it was a mixture of, I was the Tom York essentially, but I was also doing the guitar solos when it needed to be required. So I was pulling a Johnny Greenwood, like, you know, I was smashing on the whammy pedal and hitting the Marshall Stratmaster and then just like going crazy on it.
Very cool. What was the band's name?
We called it Cut Tooth, which was a B-side of a Radiohead. On a Radiohead album, because we're all very into their stuff. So, but yeah, it didn't make it past the one-time battle of the bands in the high school after I went to college.
And Cut Tooth sounds like it's going to win the IGF prize for best indie game. I love the sound of it.
Yeah.
And then, so you're obviously also into Japanese stuff and you do East Asia studies, like I said, at Brandeis University. Where was that all coming from, that interest?
Yeah, so I had grown up, one of my best friends in elementary school was Japanese. I had visited Japan once when I was in high school, and I was just kind of like very enamored with the culture.
How did you get to do that, visit in high school?
Well, I stayed with her family. You know, we had grown up together, our families were close, and there were times where, because all the friends were locally in New York. So she would come over, she would come visit our group of friends, stay with one of them. And then one time she sent out invitations for, hey, anyone want to come to visit Japan? And I was like, that sounds cool. And everyone else said, that sounds cool. So I thought we were all going. And then eventually everyone pulled out and I was the only one who went.
So romantic.
Yeah, I know, right? And yeah, stay with, you know, this is her family and I knew their family. So it was just kind of like a throwback to, you know, elementary school years. And got to see Tokyo, just Tokyo, when I went the first time. And I always say, like, Japan, especially Tokyo, is like as close as you can come to being, I think, the U.S., while going as far away as possible as well. I don't know why. It just feels like it's very amenable. They kind of have everything that you need. It just has this kind of like this layer on top of it that you're not familiar with. So everything feels a little bit more interesting or new. You know, and I still remember being on the train, and this is so, and looking back, it's so stupid. You know, I was looking at the advertisements, and, you know, they have great sort of advertisements in general in Japan. They're very sort of visual and ridiculous sometimes, but there was the hiragana, which is one of the letters that you used for spelling for the sound of no, which kind of looks just kind of like a, almost looks like a pig's nose, if you want to say. It's kind of a, but I just saw that, and I was like, what is that? And it's just like, they're like, oh, that's just a sound. It means no. And I was like, what does it mean? It's like, no, it's just a sound. So it'd be like saying if someone's the letter B on a train, it's like, what does that mean? It's like, it's the letter B. It doesn't mean anything. But yeah, it was just like so cool. And I was like, you know what? I really want to study Japanese once. And when I finally got the chance to in university, and I was terrible at it, honestly. I was very, very terrible. But I kept trying and I did study abroad. I studied abroad in Kyoto, actually, for a year, which I loved. And so I was like, you know what? I really like that. And I gained a lot of skills in speaking Japanese as well. And I said, you know what? When I finish school, I want to come back and spend a little bit more time and learn a bit more Japanese and then kind of figure out what I want to do. So that's kind of how I ended up coming back here.
Well, we'll put a pin in that for now and come to your second choice. So
cool.
Yeah, we were discussing what year this came from and looked it up before we started recording. 2011, this game. What's the game, John?
Okay, so the game this time is Portal 2. Thank you. that ever coming up from like beep, 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 like the soundtrack for that. Yeah, right. Portal 2 was a game that, like, I would say when I played it, you know, I played Portal 1 and I liked it. And I thought it was just like everyone else. I thought it was a really cool idea. It was executed very well. And I went into Portal 2 being like, no way they're going to do something that's better than this. Like, there's nothing they could do that can enhance this experience. And I played through Portal 2 and I was just like completely blown away. And some people, I see some of, like, retroactively still like don't like it because of all the extra stuff they added off. They're like, I love the simplicity of the original one. I don't know, this adding of like the world, the sort of the story elements to it, the humor in it.
Yeah.
The puzzles were extremely well executed and smart. Nothing was frustrating. It even had that co-op mode that was super intuitive for the time about like kind of you can play without voice chat because you can kind of tag stuff. It's just so common in games these days.
Yeah.
But I remember playing through it and because it plays off the fact that it's a sequel to the first one so well as well. Like you wake up in kind of like the same situation. You see the same places that you saw in the first game, so you remember that, and then you see how much time has passed. But the thing that blew me away was like the scale of everything. Like in the first game, you knew that you were in these labs, but it was part of this bigger thing that you really didn't understand. But this time, you kind of got to see it, and it was so like ridiculous in scale that it kind of made you feel like I'm experiencing this like small part of this gigantic world, and I don't even know what year it is. I don't know if we're still on the same planet, like, or anything. And it just gets crazier and crazier. And up until the ending, you know, which, you know, if you haven't played, like, I think it's just the moment that it clicks with the last thing that you're supposed to do to finish off the game is like just such a just like a fun moment.
Yeah,
of just like a kind of like a nice little, like, you know, like cherry on top. But it's just so smartly done. And the only thing that I hate about it is that it's a puzzle game, so you know the solutions. So I can't go back and play through it like I can for the first time. It was one of those games where as soon as I finished, I was like, I wish I could just delete this from my memory and play it fresh again, but I can't do that.
Do you not forget that stuff? I feel like within 3 weeks, I've forgotten all that stuff.
I probably, for me, unfortunately, like, I forgot 50% of it,
right.
But then when I'm playing it, I'm like, I remember this one. And I want that kind of like surprise of, oh my God, what's going to happen next type thing. I mean, yeah, I might play it again and be like, oh, this is the part where I need to slide with the goop on the floor. And it's like, this wasn't as cool as the last part, but it's still fun. I don't know. It's something that, to be honest, I came back to it once and that's what I realized I remembered more than I did. And I haven't come back to it since. And it's always been intentional because I'm trying to push it off as much as I can to find that moment where, like, I really kind of don't remember it that well, that I can play it almost fresh again.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So yeah, coming back to your story then, John. So yeah, you graduate university and you come to Japan to teach English, as I said in the intro. A lot of people go to like central Tokyo to do that with one of those schemes, English in Japan schemes. You go to the countryside though. What took you there?
So it wasn't my choice per se. So I was in a program called the JET program, which is it's actually a government funded program. So you kind of sign up. And they send you to a location somewhere in Japan that needs what they call an ALT, assistant language teacher. And I was sent to Ibaraki, which is just north of Tokyo. So while it is the countryside, it's not as extreme as like it is 7 hours to find the nearest like telephone or something like that. That's something like that. But, you know, if I wanted to, I can go down to Tokyo in like 2.5 hours or something by train.
Yeah.
So it's not that removed, but it was enough that, you know, you needed a car to get around. When all the lights in the city turned off, I think around like 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. or something like that. So it was just pitch blackness because it's just fields of, you know, it's rice fields and things like that. For one, it helped for me for learning the language because it was like, again, total immersion. You didn't have that way out of being like, I'm just going to go over to the English pub that is in town and just talk to the locals there. So it gave me a lot of chance to kind of focus on my studies, learn a bit more about just general sort of living in Japan, the culture, things that, you know, things that's like common knowledge or, you know, for anyone who was here. And honestly, I don't think the goal was for a long-term stay in the end, you know, because I was actually applying to maybe go back to graduate schools in the United States.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, I was thinking of, I was doing that translating work. I was thinking of, I'd love to be more professional in that, teach about Japanese literature. I was very into that. You know, looking back, was that a good career choice? I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of money to be made in that per se. But it was just kind of the only thing I kind of saw as an option at that point. But it was during that time where I found, you know, the kind of work I was doing now as well.
Yeah, so you see an advertisement for a job at Tango, which hadn't been going long at all, I guess. What made you take that jump? Because, you know, that's obviously a little different to everything you've been doing up until that point.
Yeah, so you're right. It wasn't even, didn't have a name yet either. It was called, I think at that point, the Shinji Megami Project.
Okay.
And he's like, I'm starting a new studio. And I think I saw an article on a gaming website saying, you know, check out this bizarre webpage for this new studio, which was a flash game where you kind of charge up a meter and cut off Shinji Mikami's head, and how much you charge it up, like, is how far the head will fly. And if you reach over a certain score amount, it brought you to a application page, this webpage.
They're just already filtering out skill list.
Yeah, it's like the equivalent of, you know, like the resume filter type thing. It's like, yeah, if you think this is weird, I think the idea is like, we want people who are into something to try something different, try something new. We don't want the standard applicant at this point, especially when they're probably starting a new studio. They want kind of fresh talent. But this page that you brought to for applying to a game, again, I did this with no anticipation of applying, but I was just reading it and it said, you know, they're applying for basically every position, including like game designers, things like that. But all the conditions were basically like, likes games, wants to make games, interested in games. So there's nothing like concrete, like has 3 years of experience using this engine or something like that, or has a degree in this. And I was like, you know what? Why don't I just try sending my resume there? It was literally the only job I applied to, like, ever.
Really?
In that sense. Like, I didn't have some backup, because I was applying to go to school, and I was like,
yeah,
you know, well, I probably won't get it anyway, but let's see what happens if I send a resume. It'd be cool to see what happens.
A wild card.
Yeah, it was a complete wild card.
So they called you to the office to do an interview then?
Yeah. So I applied. I sent a cover letter, which you kind of actually don't do in Japan. You send a resume and just kind of write a little bit of like what you're interested in, and then they kind of base it off that. But I wrote actually like a kind of more Americanized cover letter on top of it, saying, you know, actually like being very honest, it's like, I have no skill in game design. I just really like, A, the games you've made, and I'm very interested in helping out in the process. And specifically, this was a time where I think Japanese games were getting a lot of flack for being like too Japanese and like not appealing to a worldwide audience. And meanwhile, I was like, I grew up with those games. So I was like, I don't think that's the case. I think I felt like I was seeing games like do that and like overcompensate also too. And I was like, that's not good either. It's like, I don't want you to like lose whatever is great about these games because I grew up playing them. I don't want you to change that. So I basically made this kind of, you know, statement and sent it over. They called me over for an interview, and I brought one of those books that I translated. I just printed it all out. It was like 250 pages.
Cool.
And yeah, like I'm not expecting him to read it, but just showing like, hey, I did this, you know. And I still remember he just picked up the edge and flipped through every page to make sure it wasn't blank, and then he was like, I see, you know. And I was like, well, it was worth printing it out, I guess. It took forever. Cost that money to print that out. But yeah, we just kind of talked about games in general, like what you're playing, what you liked, what you're interested in doing. And
were you nervous?
Surprisingly, no, because this is going to sound weird, but I wasn't very familiar. Like, I knew, obviously I knew Shinji Mikami had made Resident Evil, but I'm not familiar with them in the sense of like these game celebrities in a way. Now I'm much more, as you, in the industry, obviously I'm attuned to like who's developing a game, who's involved with a project. But just as like a consumer, I just had this image of like publishers. It was like Capcom, you know, Nintendo or something like that. And there's no idea of like development studios to me. So I really didn't understand that concept. And so when I walked into the room, I was like, oh, this is the guy. Okay, cool. You know, and so maybe the lack of sort of being familiar with it made me just being like, oh, it's just a person who makes games, you know? It's just a guy. And realistically, when you work with these people, you realize like they're just dudes. They're just people. They make mistakes. No one's perfect. No one's like some creative genius that is just like is 100% accuracy in everything they do. It's more about like knowing what's interesting, following through with the plan, and then making sure that you execute on a vision. And that's a lot of problem solving and being logical and smart about a lot of stuff.
Well, we'll pick up the story again in a minute, but this seems like a good time to come to your third game, which is made by a director who people consider to be more than just a dude. But yeah, what's your third choice, John?
Okay, my third choice is Bloodborne. So probably a lot of people, when they, you know, they think of like the Souls series, they immediately go to probably like Dark Souls. It's their favorite. Maybe some people say Demon Souls, stuff like that. Maybe now even maybe Elden Ring or something. But there is like a definite group of people who like have latched on to Bloodborne and see that as like the ultimate version. And for me, actually, Bloodborne was the first one of these FromSoft games, the sort of the Soulsborne. Or now, and now it's expanded, right? It's like Soulsborne, Ekiro, Ring. Yeah. That I was able to actually get past. I had like tried Dark Souls when it came out and I could not get past the first boss. I just could not understand how to play this game. Bloodborne 2, I had a lot of problems, but I was able to, with the co-op play, get past what was the boss in the cathedral? It was like the woman who transformed into the wolf.
Oh, in the cathedral?
Yeah. Oh my God, it's like
amygdala or something, is it?
Vicar Amelia, thank you. It's Vicar Amelia. That was like, I was like, this is impossible. And I had a friend jump in and help me out and got past that. And then I kind of understood more of how to play. It's this aggression thing about like jump towards the boss. Like you're always thinking of getting far away. It's like, and there's this place out there. And then I had to relearn that when playing the Dark Souls games. But Bloodborne was like, obviously, I was playing through it, and for people who know, like, the first half is more focused on, like, these, like, monsters and this kind of, like, this almost, like, you know, Wolfman type sort of horror feel. But then the second half just goes full, like, cosmic horror in this, like, bizarre twist. But it was so cool, and the setting was, like, so cool. But also, it's also one of my biggest, like, gripes about the game. And I know this is probably an opinion that would, like, anger people, but I think... Well, I think everything about that game is so cool. They tell you so little that when you're playing through it the first time, you're like, that was cool, but I have no idea what just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go like read, you watch 10 videos and you read like the articles and or like read the whole like wiki and you realize like, oh, Rom, that spider that I fought, like that was like that changed the world. Like that was, that unleashed this cosmic being in this, like this logic that now I can see through it. And it's like, everything is different now. But when I'm playing the game, I'm like, I fell in the lake. I was like, what the hell is the spider thing? It's like, I killed it. It's like, I don't know what's going on. And so it's one of those games where like when I played it through the first time, I was like, this is really cool, but I have no idea what it is. And then after looking, reading all the lore, I'm like, this is super, super cool. And you go back and play it again, you're like, now this is like, this is totally awesome. And so while I do love it a lot, I also feel like if they were a little bit better in bringing you into the world and leading you up to that, like, I can't imagine how psyched I would have been knowing like that I was going to, someone's going to yell at me. It's like, yeah, it's written in a note in the corner. It's like, the secret is hidden under the lake. And I was like, yeah, okay. But that if they set it up, if you're like, you're going into this lake and you're going to fight this spider and this will unleash this cosmic element. And this is the most important character in this universe. You have no idea what you're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead of like killing it, being like, oh, spider guy's dead.
right.
But
I can see the headlines now. John Johannes wants Bloodborne to be more like Oblivion.
Yeah, more and an easy mode included or something like that. Yeah, no, it's just I think it fits because it's the cosmic R element should just be this unknown. It's so bizarre that like you can't comprehend it, so it should be that way. But also the information is there, so they want you to kind of search for that information and find it. And that is like very cool aspect to not just that game but all the other Souls games. But I do think that there could be a little bit more push. So when you fight these bosses, you get to these points in the game, there's a little bit more realization of like, oh my God, it's coming together. This is what's happening.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm not good enough in putting the clues together. But I don't stop to read all the descriptions, right? You know.
I guess they do design it so you can sort of just ignore all of that if you want and just take it as an action game. You know, perhaps because, you know, they don't want to force lore dumps on you, I suppose.
Of course, yeah.
So there's pros and cons, but yeah, I know what you're saying, yeah.
But pulling back, like even just as an action game itself, it's like, it's incredibly awesome. Like, it feels tactical, there's lots of moves, the enemies are extremely aggressive, and they're very cool and very well designed. Sometimes, you know, I do think that, you know, while people claim that all the attacks are very fair, I do think that some attacks are a little bit over the top and ridiculous. Like you said amygdala, like I don't know how you're supposed to, where the hitboxes on that thing are, man. That thing that's just like flailing its limbs around. I don't know what's going on, but it looks cool as hell and it feels cool as hell and it sounds cool as hell. And it's one of those games that, you know, I sometimes I'm doing something else and I just stop and you just look out to the sky and you're like, man, Bloodborne was dope. And then you just go back to your life. You know, it's just one of those moments.
So, yeah. So let's rejoin you then. You just joined Tango's as a translator. How did you move to then becoming a designer? Was it quite a natural progression?
I would say it was natural, but forced at the same time because the studio was so small. I think it was the 20th employee there. It was mostly made up with people who were professionals. And so I was kind of there and I had no idea what I was doing. And I was 100% sure I was going to get fired within probably the first like 3 weeks when they realized I had no actual ability to make a game. But I was always asking people, I was like, what are you doing? And or like, do you have anything that I can translate, like game design documents or stuff like that? And they would give me some stuff and I would look at that. And since the company was so small and there's so few people and the office wasn't that big, people were talking about like ideas for projects or something like that. And I was being very, I don't know what the word is. Is callous the correct word or something like that? Of, you know, people would say ideas and I would just turn my chair and be like, that sounds terrible. And then just like turn back to my seat. And it's like very, very annoying person to do.
High risk strategy.
High risk. Yeah. That sucks. Or no, I didn't say that. I was like, no, I was like, that doesn't sound interesting. Like, what about this? Or I was like, I was trying to give like bit like an idea of like,
right.
What about, wouldn't this be cooler if you did that or something like that? And, but again, it was very sort of, you know, an unlearned opinion of my input. So it was me giving ideas I just thought were cool. And then I learned, you know, through failure, it's like, no, you can't do that because like, then that would mess this up. It's like, okay. You know, so kind of like learning by doing, which is, you know, majority of my career. But then, you know, I was doing it so often that I think maybe Mikami-san saw something in me or just maybe wanted to make it official that you're being you're involving yourself enough, let's just do this, that like, hey, do you want to just join the game design team as like a game designer? And I said, yes, it sounds super cool. And I did that, also assuming I would then be fired immediately, because then when I would actually have work that required game design, which I had no knowledge for, then it's only a matter of time, but they figured out that I couldn't do it.
It's quite a, I mean, you mentioned earlier that Shinji Mikami was one of the creators of Resident Evil, obviously one of the most famous and popular horror series in the world, and you work on The Evil Within, which was sort of his own, you know, new take on a horror game. What's I was just interested, you know, what kind of designer was he? Was he quite high concept, or was he right in the weeds with the rest of the design team, all of you there?
So I can only speak for how he was on that project, right? Because he founded that studio, or this studio, with the idea of giving, you know, new talent a chance to kind of either have directional control or be more involved in game development. He would say that to us. He's seeing more and more that it's pulling its way. It's more of like a group mentality. People making one part of a game that they don't know what the rest of the game is. He wanted it to be more of like the sort of creator-driven process.
Right.
And so what I saw was a little bit of a hands-off feel towards the way he was doing directing, because he was giving out these ideas, these key points. He's like, take this, show me what you can make with this. And maybe this was his like experiment, because I've heard from other people that sometimes he's very, very hands-on and he's like designing the levels. He'll take the maps, he'll redraw them and stuff like that. He was much more like overseeing and making sure that, you know, we were doing the best that we can do. I didn't want to compete in this. This is where I wanted to other people to lose per se, but I was like, oh, I want the things that I'm responsible for to be like the best part of this game. So I was like very driven in that respect. But the way that it was set up is, you know, he gave us that creative control over these levels that we did. So in the Evil Within, I had two stages that I was kind of responsible for. And throughout the game, like it evolved. Sometimes one was cut and I got another one instead. But it was always like, here's the concept. What do you think about this? And you show it off. Mm. And then you get your responses to that. And it's like, well, here's this like the story aspects of the thing we fit in. Here's this cool situation. Like, what if we put this cutscene in where this happens? And it's like, oh, that's really cool. Let's put it in. We're like, no, that doesn't fit in, or we don't have like the manpower to do that. You have to pull off on that. So it was much more, to me, it felt, while there was a direction, he was very much giving the steering wheel to the designers of each individual section to kind of do what you can. And if there was something that obviously needed help, needed to be shaped up, you saw him step in and work on that to fix it. But what I saw, which I liked and I tried to do in my project, is make sure that the teams or the people involved have ownership over the things that they make.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be degrees of like how involved you are as a director. Sometimes like for Hi-Fi Rush, I was extremely involved in all aspects, but I still wanted people to feel like they were still making, they still can call something like, I made that stage, I made that sequence, I made that level. And I feel like that's very important.
Well, yeah, John, time flies. So we better come to your fourth game. Sorry to rush you, but tell us about this one. So we're heading to the US for this setting. Yeah, what's the game? Why do you love it?
Okay, this time the game is Red Dead Redemption 2. It was a game that, again, I thought, I liked Red Dead Redemption 1. I thought there's no way that they can beat this. I saw promotional stuff coming out, and I'm like, this does not look like my type of game at all. They took all the cool stuff out that I liked. I don't like this new character. He looks lame. What's all the simulation stuff? This is lame. And then when I finally got around to playing it, I understood what this game was, and it is this beast of a thing. Like, it's not a game more than it's like a simulation of like actually living through this time period and experiencing life in the Wild West. And I spent so much time with the main game, and I still think it's one of the best stories that I've seen in games told. I wound up loving the character Arthur Morgan, absolutely amazing. The arc that it goes through, the ending, it like left me like emotionally in shambles, and I just loved everything about it. And then what I did is I played the online portion, which I didn't expect to be good at all, and I feel upset because I wish it was supported more. And I think anyone who plays the online version probably knows exactly what I'm talking about, because it's such a good like simulation. It's actually more so than the main game of like, of kind of, let's build a life in the West. It's like, let's hunt for food. Let's do all these things. You can pick trades. And the game pace is so slow. It's like, I can play for 2 hours and maybe I did one small little thing, but it felt like I was just chilling out. I was riding my horse into the sunset and playing with friends and things like that. It was like the ultimate like cowboy simulation game, which I'm not even a fan of cowboys, to be honest. I'm not like a Western movie fan of them. So, but it's like everything they did, they pulled off so well, and it obviously looks gorgeous and all the systems work so well. It's all this stuff that you're like, there's no way they did this. And it's like, they did it, you know, whether it's a mechanic or some hidden secret, or it's like, what if you do this in this situation? They figured it out. And so like, I never would put anything past, you know, what Rockstar is able to do. It's like, anything you think, they can't top that. It's like, I would never say that at this point. Yeah, so they have the manpower to do it too.
That, something I was expecting to read a lot more about was the ending where in that game where you sort of, I won't spoil it, but you play as a different character, don't you? And a sort of coda to the game, which is, and it's so masterfully done. And I almost didn't read anything about it. I think probably because people were pressed to get the reviews out and maybe didn't get that far, because it's like, you know, 80, 90 hours into the thing.
Yeah, the game's massive.
It was,
yeah,
just so well handled. Yeah, it's a really, really special.
Well, the first one, they did the same thing. Like,
yeah,
in the first Red Dead Redemption, like, it did have that sort of coda sequence. But yeah, this is an interesting one because it's a sequel that's actually a prequel, right?
Right.
And you kind of see like, oh, how is this going to lead into it? And they show you that in its own way, and that is just incredibly interesting. And even actually makes then the previous game more interesting, because you see how it connects and what that means. Because a lot of the characters in the second game are returning characters from the first game, but you saw how they turned into those characters. So it makes even those scenes where you just like a character who's just like a one-off villain, for example, now there's like this like story and you feel like, oh my God, that's what's become of them and things like that.
Yeah.
For a game to retroactively make the original one even better is some sort of weird cosmic miracle in a sense.
Great. All right. So yeah, so Red Dead Redemption 2. So yeah, so as I said in the intro, John, your game High for Us, you just come to PlayStation 5. It's been out on Xbox for a little while now, but and since the initial launch, the industry has, well, you know, been pretty much on fire, I'd say. You know, reportedly 20,000 jobs nearly lost in the last few months across the games industry. Do you think Hi-Fi Rush would be harder to make today if you were starting? Or has the game sort of made it possible for you to do more of this kind of thing?
I don't know if it'd be harder to do or not. You know, we got that a lot of people saying like, this is such a big risk. This is such a big risk. But I feel like any game making now is quite a risk to make. You know, game development cost itself is not cheap. So even making something that you think is a home run on paper, if it's not executed correctly or the timing is off, it's like that could, you know, a giant budget behind it could mean that might not succeed as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I will kind of always side with the idea of like, if a game is good, people will play it. So just focus on making a very, very good game, a game that's interesting, a game that people can talk about, a game that people will remember, and it'll find its audience. But to make it now, it's tricky because, you know, there's always new concepts coming out, and I would say a sequel, like games that are just a sequel aren't a surefire win either. A licensed IP isn't a surefire win. I think people want new IPs because, you know, people want to try something new. But there's also, I understand from a user point that there's like a little bit of trepidation. It's like, if I'm going to spend my money on something, I want to spend my money on something that I know is going to be good.
I suppose in a way, like the, you know, smaller games, by which I mean, you know, it's not trying to be a live service game or anything like that, as are in a way a sort of maybe a safer bet for investors right now, because there can only be so many Fortnites and Call of Duty Warzones in the world, right? And it seems like there's lots of creative, interesting space, and also, you know, maybe a surer bet for investors to fund these kind of projects. I'd like to hope, at least, you know, because I think that leads to more creativity, maybe.
Of course, yeah. I love to see more games being creative on what they're able to do. Obviously, you know, I think the issue right now is that regardless of whatever game you're making, like we talked about, like, you know, development costs are high, but also the time to develop is higher because we put in a lot of effort, people are more skilled. We spend a lot more time on them to make sure that they're good. We play test them. And so whatever you make, there's a significant investment into it. So even, you know, I see people online, they think that, like, you know, oh, this was Hi-Fi Rush, this is a small project that they were just making in the meantime, and they pumped out in a couple months or something like that. Or like, yeah. But, you know, we were working on it for 5 years. It was a significant investment from us, for the development team, of being like, we're going to make this, we're going to execute on it well, and we want this to be, whatever game it is, if it's a bigger game or a smaller game, to be the best game that we're going to put out.
Yeah, yeah.
And so is it risky? I think, you know, actually the fact that it's different is more appealing, but it's, you kind of have to figure out a way to, you know, make people understand what that is, as well as is the risk involved with a new IP as well.
There's been some changes as well at Tango in the last year or so. Why did Shinji Mikami leave the studio?
I think that would be a question that you would have to ask him rather than me.
Well, then for you, what sort of adjustment has that been for you and like the other staff, you know, working? I suppose anyone who works at a company and the founder leaves, that can be an adjustment, right? So how have you found that transition? Has it been smooth or not?
Well, yeah, the company was founded obviously by Shinji Mikami, and like we talked about before, about, you know, it's breeding a new generation of talent, you know, ideally. And through the process of all the games we made, we've accumulated a lot of experience, not just with myself, but with a lot of the other developers. So, you know, when we were making Hi-Fi Rush, for example, he was extremely hands-off for that project. He almost completely trusted the development team with the creative decisions and the execution and everything like that. And was there sort of, again, as like a mentor if we're struggling with something, if we need someone to talk to, there's that aspect of it. But it was through that process that I think that we saw that, you know, and it's not to say that, oh, it's a dispensable resource. Like we don't need him or something like that. But as developers now, you don't have to rely on that to make a project or to make a game or to put something out with the vision. You know, obviously it's an asset that if there is great to have, but I think at that point we've kind of grown to the point where we're able to try new ideas and pull them off in our own way. And that's exactly what the studio was founded for. So for us, it's we always want to continue that tradition. It's making sure that whatever we're putting out is very creative. Like there's a creative head, and it's that creative vision is driving the project. It's not just about, you know, like if it's tracing a trend or something like that, it's something that we are very passionate about and we want to do. And so we want to keep the spirit of that alive, because that's, you know, it's not just a person, that's what the studio is.
All right, John, let's come to your fifth and your final game then. Tell us about this one.
Okay, the final game on my list is Returnal. man, this game is dope as hell. And it's hard to argue against it. I don't know why, because for me at least, it combined all these aspects that I really love. I love third-person shooters. I love high-speed stuff. I love, as you can tell with Bloodborne as well, this like cryptic Lovecraftian or like, you know, cosmic horror-esque plot line. And this kind of ticked all the boxes for me. And while I'm usually not a big like roguelite fan or roguelike fan, and some people actually saw this one as being a more intense one and very difficult, I was somehow able to play it because actually I quickly rebinded the controls because at that time we were developing Hi-Fi Rush. So he had the character had the same move set basically as Chai in our game. So I was like dashing and I was like parrying and doing this stuff. So everything was, for me, it was just like an extension of me developing the game. But it's such a well-executed game from a studio that's also kind of not known for making a game of that caliber. Housemarque has been known for the sort of arcade stuff, and they branched out, I think, was it Dead Nation or something? Was that kind of more realistic look at things like that? But nothing to this level. This was probably the riskiest project that they have ever taken on with the scale of it. But they pulled it off so well by the gameplay was so well done. The weapons were super cool. All the enemy designs were cool. It had this cool layer of the story element of the way replaying it kind of made it feel like you're actually moving on to discovering the secrets of the story, which is, again, people say like, that's all roguelites and stuff like that. But the way it was just kind of executed in this one, I thought was just much cooler. And it happens to have like one of the coolest boss fights I had played in such a long time. And it's not the last boss. I don't think it's like a complete spoiler, but the game is separated into two acts, and there's a boss at the end of the first act that was like one of the coolest things I played through in a long time. It was like you're on this platform. It started as like you're just fighting in this like, you know, this empty space void, and then all of a sudden these platforms are blowing up and you're kind of free falling. You have to like constantly grapple up to platforms and while shooting in the distance, and I was like, how did they pull this off? Like, it just seems so cool. But also, if you play the game up to that point, you know that you're playing through like biome one, biome two, biome three without dying to get here.
Yeah.
The stakes are so high.
High stakes, yeah.
And you're like, I can't lose here. And then when you finally do beat it, you get what is the most like gut punching like story twists in a game. Again, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't played this yet, but this is, to me, it was like, well, you know that there's more game coming, but the way they show, the way they kind of set it up and they execute on like, okay, you think it's over? It's like, no, it's not. And this is how things have changed. And just, it actually starts with the most downer feeling you can have possible. It's like, and it kind of goes to the end. And to be honest, it, just like my inability to comprehend Bloodborne, even though I did everything in Returnal, and I'm still kind of like, I really don't understand what happened in the game. Even reading the, you know, and I think this time it was at least very, very intentional. They leave it up to like, you know, is it the, what do we call it? The unreliable narrator?
Yeah.
Is it just something that we can't comprehend? Is it actually just the simple version that it's all in the mind type thing? But they leave it open well enough that it just feels so cool to be done with it and being like, man, I wonder what that was about. But the cool thing about that game is that it's so replayable. And
yes.
It's when, you know, I'm a big person who, like, when I get all the trophies in a game, I'm like, I'm done. Okay, done. But that one was like, I got everything and I just kept going.
Oh, you just?
I just kept going and playing again. I was like, there's nothing left to do, but I was like, I just want to. And I was testing out like some combinations. I was like, let me see if I can beat this boss with just this weapon in this. And able and do in less than 5 seconds or something like that.
Right. Yeah, it's very rare to get a developer that is so accomplished in arcade style, you know, two games. Like that's Housemarque's heritage, like you were saying, and then is able to bring that into a 3D action game. Those, you know, they're few and far between, those kind of games, aren't they? But when you get a design team that really understands those, like, you know, 4-minute play loops, how to make them amazing, and then can transpose it into a much bigger project. It's amazing stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and I can, and, you know, I just came back from GDC and I was able to see a talk from one of their concept artists talking about like the production period and stuff like that. And while it wasn't like an in-depth of the full making of the game, you can tell that this was an extreme challenge from the team that they took on. And you can probably tell that they went through a lot of iteration on figuring out how do we like not lose our identity, but make this type of game that we want to make. And to see how well they pulled it off is just fascinating. And obviously, you know, for next gen releases, to me, I still think it looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
the VFX work there is so cool. The art design is amazing. It really feels like a next gen experience. I always use a great example. If you ever play with the audio features, when I was playing with that, I was like, this is the first game that I felt like I really understood like this sort of 3D audio done in a very well executed way. But all around, just fantastic game. And so that's why if it's on a console, a lot of these games, you can just keep playing them for as long as possible. So that's actually why I pick these games, because the idea is like, if there's only five games, like I have to be able to play it multiple times. The only exception would be Portal. It's like, I need to...
Which you don't want to, you don't even want to replay that once.
Yeah, I just look at it on the machine. It's like, you have five game selection. I'm replaying it, like all the other ones. And I just look at it, I'm like, not yet. Maybe it's a reason to live, right? Yeah, I'm stranded on an island. It's like, I want to survive to forget Portal 2 so I can play it again. That's the reason it's there.
Right, well, let's go through your consoles. So we've got Earthbound, Portal 2, Bloodborne, Red Dead Redemption 2, and Returnal. Wonderful. Great console.
Some cool stuff, yeah.
We need a name for it to market to the world. What would you like to call it, John?
Oh, my God. I should have thought about this before. I don't have a good name for this.
What's your favorite console title from a console that is out in the world?
Favorite console title, like the name of a system?
Yeah, maybe base it on that.
Well, I love the Dreamcast, so maybe this is the Cosmic Horror Cast. I don't know. It's terrible. It's terrible. Don't do that. Don't do that. Does not roll off the tongue at all.
Well, let's call it Cosmic Horror Cast for now, and you can let me know on email if you want to change it, and I'll drop that in.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. All right. Well, I'm going to let you go, but just before I do, you mentioned the Dreamcast there. I know Hi-Fi Rush is not like a remake of any games. It's very much its own thing. But are there any games from the Dreamcast era that you'd like to have a go at reinterpreting? Any other ones that you love in particular?
Oh, man. You know, that's such a good... I think that's my favorite console, because it everything, A, was just fun. And also, it was like the first step up that really felt like things were like the next generation of things. And one thing I always joked about, and I don't think there's no plan for me to do anything with it, because I just wish they would release another one, is like, I played the shit out of Power Stone.
Right. Yeah, the four-player brawler type thing.
Well, yeah, first game was two players. Power Stone 2 was four players.
Okay,
yeah. And but it was, and there was very little strategy involved, but it was just like kind of this post-Smash Brothers, like more just kind of like over-the-top, like, but kind of... with Marvel versus Capcom type stuff. And I just loved how ridiculous things were and how chaotic things were. And it's like, if you survive, like maybe you got a chance. That was such a cool game. Just every day I saw they're making new ones. So that's great. Awesome. Man, what else? I played so much stuff on there. Like Phantasy Star Online, the original one I played for so long.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The first game with like that I played with the internet access stuff. That was really cool. But even like even with all bugs and all, like I still love the first like Sonic Adventure. Seeing that like world in 3D and moving that fast through the world just like was just kind of like mind blowing for a little bit.
Yeah, it looked a lot better than it played, I think, but it did look very, very good, didn't it?
Yes,
Sonic Adventure.
But also, the Dreamcast games are unfortunately a little bit of like, you know what? It's best don't replay them. Just remember them.
Because
I think they were just at the cusp where they don't have that quite the. Either the intuitiveness or the user functionality, like auto saving or things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like rough. But I remember them as being very clean and very colorful and fun to play. And I bet if I go back and try playing all those ones I remember, I'd be very frustrated and then not like them anymore. So
right, yeah.
I kind of do this thing where I put them aside and I'm like, you know what? Some things are best left in the memories.
Yeah. Well, that said, I'm looking forward to Tango Gameworks making Power Stone 3. So
yes,
watch this space.
Yeah. Watch this space for you.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks so much, John. It's been great to get to know you a bit. And yeah, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you for having me. I love this. I love this conversation. I love this podcast because you said.
Yeah, we can say podcast.
Okay.
Thank you so much to my guest, John Johannes. A real treat to talk to John, to hear his memories, his story, his wonderful game picks. I loved all of his choices there and the ways that he talked about them as well. His game, most recent game that we were talking about there, Hi-Fi Rush, is out now. It's available on PlayStation 5, on the Xbox Series X and S, and also on Steam. You should play it. It's a wonderful game and the kind of game that doesn't get made very often these days, as we were discussing in the chat there. But I think the kind of game that we would like to encourage more companies to back, you know, a new IP, a new idea for gameplay, a stylish, colourful, blue skies kind of aesthetic. Like John said, not the kind of game that we readily associate perhaps with Bethesda, the company best known for Oblivion and Skyrim and Fallout and some of those muddy games, is that the right word? You know, fantastic games, of course, but Hi-Fi Rush is like a real candy-coloured, you know, sugar rush of a game. And so, yeah, it's wonderful that Bethesda funded it, and I hope that they continue to back that studio and as they explore these creative avenues. A couple of times in that recording, I and John forgot the names of key characters. So, for example, the protagonist in Red Dead Redemption 2 and the person that you fight in the cathedral in Bloodborne as well. So I am grateful to our friendly PR person who was sitting in on that call. I do tend to try and say if there's a PR chaperone on these recordings, which there are, it tends to be... Ironically, perhaps it tends to be people from the video game industry, the companies send a PR person. But if you're speaking to a very famous comedian, then they kind of let you just go on with it. But that says something about the way video games see themselves, I think. Anyway, I was very, very glad to have our PR person on this one, not least because he was able to jump in with some help there on those names of characters, but also because he's a friend of mine, Samuel Roberts, who... listeners of this podcast and other British games podcasts may know from the Back Page podcast, which he hosts with Matthew Castle. So yeah, Samuel is a wonderful chap, and it's thanks to him really that I got to do this. He was the person who suggested that John comes on the show and was able to make it all happen. So thank you, Samuel, for all of that, and for also helping us out with some of those names. I did sort of slightly cheat the edits, so it looked like it was a lot quicker coming up with the names than it was in real time on the call. But anyway, Samuel, thank you for jumping in on that. And if you've not listened to Backpage Pod, I have recommended it on here before I think my Christmas best of show. I was talking about it, and I have appeared on that podcast one time as well. But it's a great podcast, especially, you know, two veteran video game journalists who've worked in magazines here in the UK for a long time, and you know, talking about the games that they love from particular years, and they've got lots of different fun formats as well. So listen to that, give it a listen if you've not done so before. Yeah, it was great as well to have John pick Bloodborne. He was, after the chat, he was a little concerned that maybe he had been a little too harsh on Bloodborne's lore, or the way that at least From Software handles its storytelling in its games. Famously, it's all quite murky, and they leave some of the finer story points in sort of item descriptions, and you have to kind of put it together from the scraps of dialogue that some of the enemies you encounter might say to you or whatever. And some people love that. Some people wish it was a little more explicit. You know, for my part, I quite like that they keep that separate, so you can just play these games as very straight, systemic playpens if you want. And if you want to go searching for the story behind the world, then you're free to do so. I totally take John's point, and I don't think he was speaking out of turn there at all. He was just saying, you know, for him, going and finding that stuff after the fact, he found that it increased his enjoyment of the game. So why not put that more front and center? So anyway, I think you can take what he was saying in the spirit it was intended, as a, you know, he's speaking out of a place of respect and passion. On the subject of Bloodborne, I think I've mentioned this once before, but I worked on a Bloodborne book with the publisher Tune and Fairweather. They make extremely high quality sort of coffee table books, but especially focused on From Software titles. They do not only video game books, but they also do, you know, fine art books and other things like that. It's a sort of new publisher set up by Jason Killingsworth, a former editor at Edge magazine and writer on games, who set up a book publishing company. And the Bloodborne book I worked on is a sort of collection of essays from writers whose work I love, and writing about some of the stuff that we were talking about there, some of the lore and what is the sort of cosmic horror of Bloodborne. It's a game all about plague and pandemic and stuff like that, even though the game came out long before the COVID pandemic. So yeah, it's a collection of essays by different writers with some beautiful paintings as well, inspired by the game, of the different characters that you encounter within it. Head to tuneandfairweather.com and you'll be able to search for the book there. It is called Blood Echoes, a Bloodborne Anthology. I really can't stress how beautiful this object is. It's printed on paper in Italy and there is truly no expense spared. So yeah, it's a very beautiful object. If you were a fan of Bloodborne, then you will want it on your shelf. And of course, have a look at the other books that Tune and Fairweather produce around some of the other games, the Dark Souls series, as well as lots of other things that, if you listen to this podcast and enjoy Miyazaki's games, and I'm sure you will also be a fan of. Yes, I hope you will excuse me asking that little question out of the blue about why Shinji Mikami left Tango Gameworks. There hasn't really been any information about that. It just happened at some point in the last 12 months or so, and you know, I don't know. It would be pure speculation for me to say why Mikami moved on. Shinji Mikami, if you don't know, I mean, we did mention briefly some of the things he's worked on, but he was best known perhaps for his work when he was at Capcom, mainly I suppose for being the inventor of the Resident Evil series, or Biohazard as it is known in Japan. He also worked on Disney's Aladdin, so it's not all sort of horror stuff, but he worked on Dino Crisis, which is a series that's long overdue a return, if you ask me. He also worked on some cult favourites such as God Hand, and a favourite of mine, Vanquish, which I think is a very fine game. He also was, I think, a creative director on Shadows of the Damned. And there is a remaster slash remake of Shadows of the Damned coming out. This was produced, I think, by Grasshopper Manufacturer. And in fact, Grasshopper leaked the information, or, you know, maybe it was a mistake, maybe it wasn't. But anyway, in their blurb write-up for Shadows of the Damned, the remake, they mentioned that Mikami, having left Tango Gameswork, has set up a new studio called Kamui. So K-A-N-U-Y. That's not an official announcement, but they put it on their website. And so, you know, a few places made news stories out of that. So what am I saying? I suppose it looks like Mikami hasn't retired. That's something that I guess we can say, if that information is correct. So we'll keep looking out for what he's up to. And yeah, I appreciate John for rolling with the punches a little bit with that question, and just giving, you know, what's a diplomatic answer as well, but also a truthful one, I suppose, about how Mikami had set the studio up to raise up new young talent to make new things. And so that's exactly what they plan to do, even after the founder has moved on. Right, on to podcast matters. Thank you for listening along this deep into the podcast. I hope you enjoy these little chats at the end. We've had some fine guests this month. It was a treat to have Siobhan Reddy on the podcast last week. And next week, a slight change of pace. I've been having a few more people from the video game industry, people who make games or work in other areas. That's because a lot of the feedback I get is that that's who you enjoy hearing from. So perhaps people that who make games, who are involved in games that we don't often get to hear about on podcasts. So yeah, that's why I've been doing that. But next week, we are having a comedian, a very fine comedian. We're having Sarah Keyworth. If you live in the UK, you might have seen Sarah on Mock the Week or 8 out of 10 Cats. They've been on Richard Osman's House of Games and also has done a live at the Apollo showing. So yes, but anyway, it's a great chat. Sarah's got some wonderful games and some wonderful thoughts on them. And I'm so glad to have Sarah on the podcast and I'm excited to share that episode. If you want to read more about upcoming guests and you want a little bit more of a peek behind the curtain, then please do consider becoming a Patreon supporter of the podcast. To do that, you go to patreon.com/myperfectconsole. There, for about the cost of a magazine a month, you can become a supporter. You'll get your episodes early and ad-free. You'll get access to the My Perfect Console community, a lovely group of people. You'll get heads up of who the guests are each month for a full month in advance. You will get also bonus episode each month for the My Perfect Game of the Month play along. This is a bit like a book club that we're running. So each month we play through a game collectively. For the month of April, we are playing Stephen's Sausage Roll, the very highly regarded PC puzzle game that was picked by previous guest of the show, Patrick House, the neuroscientist. And later on this month, I'll be recording a special episode with the comedian Glenn Moore, previous guest of the show, of course, brackets, and that episode will be going out to supporters only. So yeah, consider becoming a Patreon supporter and you get access to all of that good stuff. And it's just a great way to support what we are doing here. You can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Please do send in your suggestions for guests, your feedback on the podcast. I'm so grateful to those of you who take the time to do so. But also send in any questions that you might have, because I ran a correspondence episode earlier this month. It went down really, really well. So I think I'm going to do another one of those in May. So if you've got any questions you'd like to send to me about about anything you think I might be able to answer. So, you know, obviously I've been a journalist covering video games, but other things as well in the entertainment and culture space for a long time now, for The Guardian, for The New Yorker, for lots of other places. So if you're interested in any of that, then yeah, feel free to shoot me some questions or just about, video game related stuff that I may have encountered in my career. So yeah, that's myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Leave us a review if you get a spare moment as well. You can do that at Apple Podcasts or on the Spotify app. It'll only take you 10 seconds. It's a good way to help people find the podcast. Right. I'll be back again next week then with Sarah, with their five choices, and with one more perfect console. Till then, bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.